Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On podcast, where we are focused on giving hope and strength to the entire military community. Whether you're a veteran, active duty, guard, reserve, or a family member, this podcast will share inspirational stories and resources that are useful to you. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and now let's get on with the show. Hey everybody, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLucio, and today my guest is John Suzuki. John is the author of the book American Grit, From a Japanese-American Concentration Camp Rises an American War Hero. This episode is going to be a little different than some of the other episodes that we've done in that we're going to be looking at a piece of American history that doesn't get talked about too much. But first, before we get into that, I want to first welcome you to the show, John. Glad to have you here.
Hey, Scott. Thanks for having me, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. For the listeners who aren't familiar with you, your background, who you are, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, well, you know, nobody's familiar with me, so this will be new news for everybody. But I wrote this book, American Grit, and I am a huge, huge fan of the military community. My dad fought in World War II, and this book is about World War II and a kind of a dark part of what happened back then. And, you know, my dad, I'm Japanese American, and my dad actually fought in the Pacific Theater during World War II. And he fought in a group called the Military Intelligence Service. And this was a group of 5,000 to 6,000 Japanese Americans, top secret group. Their job was to be interpreters, code breakers, negotiators on behalf of the United States as they fought the Japanese Imperial Army. And the amazing thing about them was that they served as the United States in the United States Army, fighting against the Japanese, and the Japanese considered all Japanese around the world as Japanese nationals. The Japanese government did, and so if these guys were captured by the Japanese Army, they were executed for being traitors, But these guys were out there. And the other thing that's really interesting about these guys in the Pacific was that they were the only group of men that I can think of that I've been able to find who actually required bodyguards by the United States Army to protect them from the United States Army because, you know, from being mistaken as the enemy. And so I love the military community. I bleed red, white, and blue. My name is John James Suzuki. My dad gave me the name John. He gave me the two most American names he could think of. and so it is. My name is John James. But yeah, and I wrote this book because it is a part of American history that is becoming forgotten, and worse yet, it's not being taught. It's not being taught, and it's such a dark part of our history, but it's such an amazing, amazing story. Everything about this is true. I didn't make anything up. It's all true, and super, super inspiring. It was a dark time, but you know, looking back at the lessons learned and how people responded, it really is something that has been an honor for me to share with folks. And we got to make sure it never happens again.
Well, yeah, I think first off, absolutely, we need to make sure that this does not happen again. Definitely a dark time in American history where so many Japanese Americans were rounded up and put in these concentration camps, and we can't allow that to happen again. Doesn't matter what the person's background is. You know, if you're an American, you're an American, right? And you know. We'll get more into this in a little bit, but we'll talk about how some of these people who were rounded up and how they overcame this injustice, and how they even went on, like your father went on and served in World War II, yep. You know, despite the fact that they were being held in these camps, and that to me is just such incredible, you know, selflessness that they were willing to put that aside and still serve the country. But we'll get more into that in just a second. When we get back, we'll talk about that. So stay tuned. Hurricane season is almost here, and the time to prepare is right now. When Hurricane Ida hit the Gulf Coast, it destroyed countless homes and left many without access to food and clean water. Millions lost power, and some for weeks. The floods that followed the hurricane washed out roads and made it impossible for grocery stores to restock their shelves. Families were left hungry and desperate, waiting for help that was slow to arrive. But what if you didn't have to rely on FEMA to provide for your family during a crisis? The answer is simple. Be prepared with emergency food kits from 4 Patriots. Their long-lasting and delicious food options are specifically designed to provide you and your loved ones with the sustenance you need when you need it most. 4 Patriots survival food kits are hand-packed in the USA. They last up to 25 years. They come packed inside covert storage totes. They include a wide variety of delicious breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, and are backed by thousands of 5-star customer reviews. 4 Patriots survival food is not just for natural disasters, because in today's world of uncertain supply chains and unpredictable emergencies, it's more important than ever to have a backup plan. Whether it's a temporary power outage, a winter blizzard, or rising food costs, you can rest easy knowing that you have a reliable source of food to see you through. And right now, you can go to 4patriots.com and use code DRIVEON to get 10% off your first purchase on anything in the store, including their emergency food supply kits designed to last up to 25 years. Just go to 4patriots.com and use code DRIVEON to get 10% off your purchase of 4 Patriots survival food. That's 4patriots.com. Use code DRIVEON.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Drive On. John, your book, American Grit, we talked about it a little bit earlier in the kind of introduction to this episode here, but it talks about the Japanese-American concentration camps that existed in the U.S. after the Pearl Harbor attacks.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about what prompted you to write this book?
Yeah. So this is a book right here for those of you who can see it. It's called American Grit. But it was a calling. It kind of to make a really long story really short. My mom was living in a Japanese assisted living facility, and one day I went to visit her, and she was in the elevator. There was this flyer that said Pilgrimage to Minidoka. Now, I don't know about you, but I didn't know what a pilgrimage was, and I didn't know what a Minidoka was. And so I just let it go. For the following 2 months, that flyer showed up everywhere. And literally the day before, and this was 15 years ago, literally the day before this pilgrimage, it showed up on my windshield. And so I'm like, okay, I ought to take the hint. So I called them up and I said, you know, you're probably sold out, but I'm one guy and wondering if you have space. And the lady said, this is pretty amazing. I just got a cancellation. Now it's yours. And so next thing I know, I'm on this bus on a 12-hour bus ride from Seattle to Twin Falls, Idaho, which is near where Minidoka was, going to a former United States concentration camp. And I told everybody on the bus going there that I didn't know why I was there, but I figured that I would know the reason why I was there on the trip coming home. And so on the third day, they had a remembrance ceremony. And we sat in front of this billboard. It looked like a billboard, but it was called the Honor Roll. And this Honor Roll had the names of 1,000 men who volunteered out of that concentration camp to fight and in many cases die for the United States Army, which was the same army that put them and their families in those camps. Right. And their families remained in prison while they went off to war by the United States Army. It was just crazy. And I had heard about the concentration camps. A lot of people call them internment camps and relocation sure. camps, same thing. But I had never, and I heard about these men who fought in the European theater and in the Pacific theater. I never heard of guys who volunteered out of the camps to go to war, and that's what prompted me to say, boy, this is a story that needs to be told, not only to let folks know about the concentration camps and to make sure that those things never happen again, but to let people know about these guys, you know, and how. I hope I can say that how kick ass our veterans are, right? And,
sure.
And, you know, it's a story that I had to tell. And I started off writing a screenplay because I thought that the fastest way to the American psyche was through a major motion picture, But I backed off over the years, and it took me 15 years of research and going to the battlefields, and just an amazing journey. But that's what American Grit's all about.
And it is an amazing story when you think about it. You think about this today, to me, it feels like it would be unimaginable for something like this to happen here in the United States, but yet it did happen. And it happened just as kind of like a knee-jerk reaction, I think, right? After the bombing in Pearl Harbor, right?
It was. There was a lot that led up to it, right? Because leading up to Pearl Harbor, the Japanese were expanding across Asia, and there was just a lot of fear of what was happening back there. And but what happened was that when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, there was a lot of widespread fear that they were going to attack the West Coast. And there was a lot of fear of, I mean, legitimate fear of Japanese spies. And sure. So one of the prevalent feelings of those days was that if they look like the enemy, they must be the enemy. And so consequently, that's what led to a thing called Executive Order 9066, which authorized the United States Army to evict and evacuate 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry, including 50,000 children and babies, and put them into concentration camps way away from the West Coast, and so much for civil liberties of those times.
Sure.
And these camps were built in literally the badlands of America, in the deserts and swamps of America, where nobody wanted to be. But it was widespread fear, and it was the war, and people feeling like you're the enemy. We gotta get you out of here. And
that's fine. Was it primarily on the West Coast that these Japanese Americans were taken from? It wasn't necessarily the East Coast. It was more focused on the West Coast, right?
No, which makes it even weirder, right? I mean, you would think that if a Japanese is a Japanese, right? Anybody of Japanese ancestry, whether it be on the East Coast or West Coast, may be a spy. There were a lot of Japanese ancestry on the West Coast, and the crazy thing about this was that they did nothing wrong. In fact, there was not a single person of Japanese ancestry that was convicted of espionage in the entirety of World War II. And so they were placed in these camps only for no other reason than their race.
Wow.
Yeah.
And, I said earlier, it's kind of unimaginable that this type of thing would happen in the United States. Mm-hmm. But then as you were talking, I was starting to think about kind of the reaction after 9/11 when people were going, and it wasn't the government necessarily going around rounding up people and putting them in camps and things like that. But there was this anti-Muslim sentiment that was going around, and there people were attacking Muslim people or the groups of people that might be congregating in certain areas. There were these attacks. I remember watching on the news people, throwing bottles and other rocks and things like that at people's cars and just trying to injure them. So, these types of things do happen. It's unfortunately, maybe it's, I don't know, is it human nature that these things happen, that we want to protect our own kind of thing? Or where does this even come from?
Yeah, I think that where it comes from is it comes from the perfect storm of a number of things happening at the same time. What you mentioned about 9/11, somebody came up with a misguided idea that all Muslims must be terrorists. And so we have to round them up and put them away someplace because they're a danger to us. And this, fortunately, cooler heads prevailed. And I will tell you that the Japanese American community was a big part of folks who were saying, stop, this can't happen again.
Yeah.
But, I talked about widespread fear. It's three things, I think. First of all, is widespread fear. Something happening that causes people to become very, very fearful. Another part of it is divisiveness. Right now we're living in a world where we're we're putting everybody in buckets, right? We got the black bucket. We got the white bucket. We got the Christian bucket, the Muslim bucket, the gay bucket, the straight bucket. We got all these buckets of people, and we have to stop. We have to stop with the divisiveness, and we have to come together, right? And my hope is that by informing people and helping people understand a little bit about our history and not letting this get stuck under the rug, right? That maybe we can all come together. And when we see that happen with the divisiveness that's happening, widespread fear, and something really bad happening, that's a third thing, right?
Yeah.
It just becomes a tsunami. And we have to be aware of that so that we can get in front of it when it all happens, because it's going to happen.
It is. And, you know, inevitably bad things happen. I mean, that's part of life, exactly. Unfortunately. I mean, I wish I could wave a magic wand and just make that not happen. But, you know, bad things do happen. There's a perceived good guys and bad guys in a lot of situations. And I think it's kind of natural to want to protect what's yours and the people that you care about and things like that. But we also have to, like you said, have cooler heads and take a step back and say, okay, not all Japanese people were bad during World War II. The people who were dropping the bombs on Pearl Harbor, I would say those people.
Yeah, go after them.
Yeah, go after those people all you want. Please, don't hold back. You know, the people flying the planes on 9/11, those people were bad. They kind of took care of themselves, but we don't need to go attacking, you know, Muslim communities or anything like that, or Japanese communities, right?
Even more recently, real quick, even more recently during COVID was the Chinese.
Sure.
Right? The Chinese community. These folks in China, in the United States, who are of Chinese descent, they had nothing to do with COVID, right? And yet they were being attacked. And so, you know, stuff like this, we just need to be aware that bad things aren't going to happen. But it's in our response that I'm trying to get in front of it.
Yeah, and I think, you know, hindsight is 20/20, is I guess the saying, right? And you can look back and say, obviously, it was a bad idea to round up all these Japanese Americans and put them in these camps, and you know that just shouldn't happen, right? But in the heat of the moment, it's so easy to just flip that switch and be like, you know what, that looks like a threat, and let's go take those people and put them away so that now I'm safe. And you kind of forget about the fact that those are actual people with rights and everything like that, that those need to be protected as well.
Exactly. And you know, it's another part of it is blame, right? It's just our knee-jerk reaction to blame somebody. Someone has to be to blame for things that go wrong, right? Stop. And you know, we're people, and so that's where, you know, bringing in a little bit more understanding. We have to stop living in so much fear, and we have to, you know, we bring a little bit more love into the world, you know. And if we do that, then maybe we'll be okay.
Absolutely. Well, I want to talk more about this and more about the stories of some of these Japanese American soldiers who volunteered to serve after the break. So stay tuned.
Attention, proud Americans. The Patriot Box is here to ignite your patriotic spirit. As a veteran-owned business, they offer hand-curated boxes filled with useful, fun, and delightful American-made products. Join their community of proud Americans and receive your very own Patriot Box delivered straight to your door. Unbox a treasure chest of quality products while supporting local small businesses and veteran charities. Check out the link in our show notes to learn more.
Hey everybody, welcome back. John, I want to take a step back here a little bit, and I want to talk about some of the stories of some of these Japanese American soldiers who volunteered to serve during World War II to fight for America. But they were in these concentration camps when they volunteered. And so how did they get to this point where they decided, hey, this is something I want to do. These people locked me away and now I'm volunteering to help them out.
Tell me some stories
about those.
Yeah, it was a crazy time. And you can imagine what it might have been like inside the camps themselves. Where some guy said, "Yeah, I'm going," and other people said, "What are you doing? What are you stupid?" Right? Because it literally pitted families against each other, even within families. But this group of men, you know, they felt like, you know, left unattended, they may end up spending the rest of their lives in these camps. And so they needed to do something to prove their loyalty and to prove mm-hmm. that they were just as deserving as anybody else to be Americans and to be recognized as Americans. So when the president, ironically, right, I mean, he put all these people in these camps, he then said, oh, we need guys from the camps to fight for the United States Army. And so these guys stepped up. And it was all about proving their loyalty and getting out there. And so one of the men was a guy named Shiro Kishino. His nickname was Cash. And when I had that experience going on that pilgrimage, I decided that I wanted to find somebody who volunteered out of the Minidoka concentration camp and went to war with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team. Now, this combat team, the 442nd, was a segregated army unit of Japanese Americans. And it was just Japanese Americans. And they went on during World War II to become the most decorated war unit in the history of the United States for its size and duration. It's just crazy stuff. And this guy, Shiro Kishino, he went to war with the 442nd, and he emerged one of the most decorated soldiers of World War II with the Silver Star, 6 Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star, and a whole host of other things. And it was so these Japanese soldiers of the 442nd came from the camps, and they also came from Hawaii, as well as other parts of the country that weren't affected by the camps. Hmm. And they all came together in Mississippi. And a bunch of there were two. What a lot of people don't understand is that there were two groups of guys. One group was from Hawaii, another group was from the mainland, and they hated each other because the guys in Hawaii spoke Pidgin English, which the guys on the mainland didn't understand. And so the guys from Hawaii thought that they were being disrespected, and there were just massive fights. What's interesting was that. The Hawaiian guys called the Japanese from the mainland katonks, because when their head hit the ground, it made the sound katonk. And the guys from the mainland called the Hawaiian guys Buddha heads, because Buddha is Japanese for pig. But anyway, they all came together when the regimental command sent some of the Hawaiian guys to one of the concentration camps for a party. And the guys never knew. They didn't know anything about these Japanese American concentration camps, and they learned that a lot of the mainland guys had their families in these camps, and so it was that night that they got back to Camp Shelby that they came together as a unit, and they became brothers. So there's just a really interesting backstory there of infighting just within this regiment of Japanese Americans. But they went on to fight a number of battles. Two of the battles that I talk about were called the Battle of the Lost Battalion. And this one battle was in the Vosges Forest in France. It's just outside a little town called Brouillers. But a battalion of Texans had advanced too far ahead. And the Germans just came in between them and the rest of the division and surrounded them, and they couldn't get them out. And the 442nd was called in to save these guys. Make a long story short, the 442nd lost over 800 guys to save 211 men.
Wow!
And they never lost a battle. They never left a man behind, And it was pretty crazy. And from that battle, there were a number of eventual Medal of Honor recipients who, by the way, got their medals of honor almost 50 years after the fact. And they were finally recognized. But Cash was wounded 3 times. And imagine, and your audience can imagine this more than anybody else, because I'm sure some of them have done this. But imagine getting halfway blown up and being told to go to the aid station, going to the aid station, getting patched up and running away before they could stop you to get back into the battle, right? He did that 3 times. And the third time, he almost had his leg blown off. And wow. This is when the guys discovered a thing called tree bursts, where the artillery was set to, the fuses on the artillery were set to detonate at treetop levels. So it wasn't just the shrapnel that came down, but it was trees that got mixed in with the shrapnel and created a much larger kill zone than when the artillery hit the ground. And it was just a massive, massive battle. And these guys didn't give up. And it took them 3 days to get there, but they saved these guys from certain death. So,
that's an incredible story of bravery getting out there and rescuing these people from, like you said, certain death. Mm-hmm. But I have to imagine not only the bravery side of things, but just the practical side of having Japanese Americans fighting with the American army had to be a big advantage, especially in the Pacific theater, where there were probably, you know, intercepted communications and things along those lines, where the language would be useful to have that.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And in the Pacific theater, and my book talks about the European theater, France and Italy, but in the Pacific theater, you know, there was the top admiral of the Imperial Japanese Navy. His name was Admiral Yamamoto. And it was our guys that intercepted communications of his travel itinerary, and they shot down his airplane and killed him. And so, you know, I mean, it's on both sides of in the Pacific and the Atlantic. There was just all kinds of by all men, every man, not only Japanese, obviously,
sure,
everybody. It was just heroism all over the place. And that's why we call them the greatest generation, right?
You know, that was actually going to be my next comment. It's like that is the reason why, because they did some incredible things that a lot of people nowadays they would consider it unimaginable that someone could do some of these things. And you know, and it's a shame too, because like you said in the earlier in the episode, that these Japanese American soldiers, they needed protection from the American army because it was very easy to confuse them for the actual enemy, because they look so similar to the actual enemy. And so, you know, I don't know that is necessarily a prejudice type thing or anything like that. It's a protection kind of thing, because, you know, it's very easy for an actual Japanese person, for someone from Japan fighting for Japan, to find an American army uniform and put it on and pretend that he's American. I can totally understand that, especially and for the listeners who probably have a good portion of them probably have served in Iraq or Afghanistan, where there were no uniforms, and so you didn't know who the good guys and the bad guys were. You know, the enemy didn't wear a uniform that necessarily shouted, "Hey, look, I'm the enemy.
I'm the bad guy."
I can really understand that mindset there. But even during obviously those camps that everyone was rounded up into, but even after the war, these Japanese American soldiers faced a lot of challenges. How did their experiences in the military affect the reintegration into society, and what did they have any sort of support, or were they looked at kind of poorly, in the American public?
So there's a short-term, long-term aspect of that, right? From a long-term perspective, their heroism and valor, absolutely. You know, I mean, they were recognized by President Truman when the first transport ship came into the East Coast, but from the standpoint of being recognized as deserving Americans, those guys took that ball way, way forward. What was really, really sad was that the rest of the country still viewed them as the enemy, right? Mm. And as I mentioned to you, before the war, if you looked like the enemy, you were the enemy. And in a lot of ways, after the war, it got worse because Japan lost. And so, you know how we feel about losers, right? And so not only were you the enemy, you were the losing enemy. A gentleman named Daniel Inouye, who passed away in 2012, he was a United States Senator for 49 years of Hawaii. And as he was coming home, he walked into from World War II. He walked into a barber shop, and the barber said, "Hey, you need to read that sign." And the sign said, "We don't cut Jap hair." Now, this man was wearing his American uniform, and he was missing a right arm. And that was the kind of treatment they got as they came back. You know, a bunch of guys coming back to the West Coast, including Shiro Kishino, he returned back to Seattle. And the veterans of foreign wars would not accept Japanese Americans from being part of the VFW. Because, I mean, these guys were the most, right? I mean, they're, right. It was crazy. And so there was just that feeling that, you know, you're Japanese, and it was hard for people to find housing. It was far hard for them to find jobs. It was just really hard for decades. But, you know, they stayed true to their American dreams of a better life for their families, and they won. And that's a big part of where the American grit comes from.
Absolutely. When we get back, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of these challenges. But more importantly, I think we're going to talk about how to prevent these things from happening again. We don't want a repeat of these situations. So stay tuned.
In a startling description, the UN food chief warned the world with the words, "knocking on famine's door." He called what we're facing a perfect storm of a perfect storm. And he's not alone. Barron's published that a food shortage could be coming, even in the U.S. Farmers see it too. John Boyd Jr., a fourth-generation farmer, told Fox News that we're going to see empty food shelves in the coming months. That's why getting survival food is more important than ever, now. Create your own stockpile of the best-selling Four Patriots survival food kits. It's not ordinary food. We're talking good for 25 years super survival food, hand-packed in a family-owned facility in the USA and giving jobs to over 200 Americans. They have different delicious breakfast, lunch, and dinner options. You can make these meals in less than 20 minutes. Just add boiling water, simmer, and serve. And right now, and for the next few days, listeners of the Drive On podcast will get 10% off their first order at 4patriots.com by using code DRIVEON. Go to 4patriots.com and use Drive On to start your stockpile today.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. John. Really, it's an to me, it's an incredible story. Thinking about the bravery and the heroism of some of these Japanese Americans who stood up, despite the fact that their country rounded them up into these camps, not just them, but their whole families, babies included, you know, rounded up into these camps, treated like second-class citizens, if you want to even call it that. And they still said, hey, let's go and serve this country, knowing that there is a better future here for them and their families, their children. To me, it's kind of inspiring hearing some of these stories that you were just talking about. How can these challenges that these people overcame, in your mind, how did this inspire people today who might hear some of these stories?
Yeah, you know, the book is just it is an incredible story, and I can say that because they're not my stories. I just wrote the book, right? But it just amazing experiences. I mean, you think about these people who are put in these camps, and you know, they're put in the middle of the deserts, right, where it got to over 100 degrees in the summer times and at zero, and maybe a little bit below zero during the winter times. And they were placed in these basically shacks made of lumber and tar paper. I mean, literally, that's all they were made out of. There was no plumbing. There's just a potbelly stove for warmth and a single light bulb in each one of the barracks. It was crazy, and yet, you know, you think about how they survived. You know, they came together. There's a Japanese saying that goes "shikata ga nai." Shikara ganai. And loosely translated, it means there's nothing you can do about it, so suck it up and get on with it, right? And they did, and they came together as a community. They came together and they built schools and they built hospitals and they built stores and they even had their own police department. And they came together as community. They even brought, amazingly, they brought irrigation to some of these areas that were just barren wasteland, and now you go to them and they're fertile farmland.
Wow.
The Japanese brought that to those areas, and so you know, I kind of look at the world today, and I think to myself, you know, we're missing some of that. We're missing that spirit of community and coming together and understanding, and it's just. You think about the people who were in the camps and what they did to survive and how they came together. That, I mean, that's super inspirational. And sure. And then after they came home and reviewed, I mean, they kept fighting for 25 years after the war into the 60s. They kept fighting, you know, because there continued to be really bad feelings towards Japanese Americans. And then you think about these guys who volunteered out of the camps and went to war. I mean, I told you about the Battle of the Lost Battalion. I did not mention the Battle of the Gothic Line. And I'll just give you two sentences. What the entire 5th Army of 200 men couldn't do in Italy, the 442nd came in and did in 48 hours. It was an epic battle. Up in the mountains where they decided to climb the backside of the mountains, which was basically a cliff. And within 48 hours, they took the top of the mountain range. But, you know, you think about it and you just go, wow. And for me, I love it because, you know, these guys and a lot of your audience, these guys are superheroes, right? They're superheroes, and they're the people that I want my kids to look up to, versus a lot of folks' kids look up to these days. Sure. I just kind of wonder why.
Right.
And so my hope is that sharing this and you know, giving people the understanding will inspire folks to understand what they did and how they won. And, you know, in this world of inclusion, you know, we're trying to figure out how to include everyone. Well, this is a story of de-inclusion and re-inclusion.
Right. You know? Right.
And so it's just a wonderful, you know, it's not your typical, this is the camps. It's a story. It's a true story. That talks about what people went through, what their experience was like, what they did, how they thought. And it just makes you go, wow, you yeah. know, and appreciate what they went through.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned the mindset that they had is like, you can't change this situation. And I would totally butcher the Japanese translation of this, but you can't control the situation. But, you know, just deal with it because this is the situation that you have to deal with. And
yep.
for the listeners, the military is probably very familiar with the phrase "embrace the suck," which to me is like the same idea. Like you can't change the fact that this sucks. It did in that situation that really sucked for those people who were going through what they were going through. You know, it was a terrible situation. It should never have happened. But it did. And it did. They made the best of this bad situation. You could sit there and whine and feel sorry about it all you want. Not going to change anything. So they did what they could to make the best of it. And they embraced that suck. And, you know, I think that's really the takeaway, I think, from this.
Yeah. Yeah. They not only embraced the suck, they did something with it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And they made... You know, it's the old stupid making lemonade out of lemons, right? But literally, sure. I mean, life's not fair. It just isn't for anybody. It's not fair. The question is, what are you going to do about it, right? Yeah. And how are you going to make the best of it? And these folks came together out of love, out of community, out of survival, mm-hmm. right? And they pulled together, and that's the kind of spirit that I'm hoping that sharing this will bring back a little bit more of, right? They didn't blame the United States government, although they did, right? But setting aside the blame and the unfairness, and they did go to court, a lot of them, and later it was decided by the Supreme Court that that whole experience was unconstitutional. And sure. So they won that. But in the meantime, you know, there weren't riots. They didn't, you know, they just figured out, how do we make the best of this? How do we come together? And the soldiers, you know, the guys in Europe and the Pacific Theater, how do we kick ass? Right? How do we show that we're just as good as anybody else? And they did, and they went out. Right. They went off and did it. And so I'm hoping that it'll offer some inspiration in different ways for people who read or listen to the book.
Yeah, you know, for me, I look at the situation and look at it like any bad situation that can happen to anybody. Now, obviously, this is a much bigger scale because you have so many people all in one place at one time who are going mm-hmm. through this type of thing. But you look at any one of those individuals who is in one of those camps, whether they are one of the people who decided to go and serve in the army, or they were, you know, a wife or a child or somebody mm-hmm. who's just they're stuck there. Right. Look at that one individual, and they got dealt a bad hand. They could sit there and whine about it and bitch and moan and all this kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, that wasn't going to improve their situation any. So right. they looked at it and said, how can I make this as good as it can be? It sucks. 100%. It's terrible. It's probably not the words that they use. They probably use some other words, but
still, yeah, probably
same sentiment was there, right? It sucks.
Yeah.
But yeah. How do we make this as good as possible? How do we figure this out and have as good of a outcome as we possibly can given the situation? And I think that's the mindset. That's the attitude. They didn't look at themselves necessarily as victims. They looked at it as, okay, there's an injustice done here. We'll deal with that later, but let's make the best of this bad situation. And that's, I think, what they ended up doing. I think it's a wonderful thing that they did, that they kind of took it in stride, and they came out, you know, better off, you know, afterwards.
Certainly better off than in the camps, right?
Sure.
But you know, it was really tough. It was especially tough for them because when the order first went out, you know, most of them lost everything, right? Mm-hmm. They lost their farms, they lost their businesses, they lost their homes, they lost their belongings. They were only allowed to carry to bring what they could carry.
Yeah.
And they had no idea where they were going, whether it be the desert or to Southern California or, you know, to the beach. Well, they knew they weren't going to the beach, but, they didn't know for how long they were going. They didn't even know if they were going to be shot, taken out to the desert to be shot. I mean, you think about it. So this is the beginning of World War II. And the only reference point they have of people being rounded up because of their race and losing everything were the Jews in Europe.
Yeah.
And so that was the only reference point they had. I mean, can you imagine how scary that was for them? And, you know, it was obviously very different because nobody was purposely shot or executed or tried to be exterminated. They were all released after the war. But nonetheless, there was a lot to be fearful of. And so once they got over that initial shock and said, okay, now what are we going to do? Like you said, these are the cards that we're going to be dealt. And, you know, it's an example, or it's a story of the concentration camps, but it's a story of life, right? It's a story of life. We are all I like to tell people, because I really, really do. I've dedicated my life to helping people make their lives better. Mm-hmm. And however I can do that. And I tell people, you know, the one thing that you need to understand that will change your life forever is responsibility, and taking responsibility is the most empowering thing you could ever do with your life.
Sure.
Because once you take responsibility and you don't blame somebody else for your circumstances, and you realize that your life is a result of the decisions that you've made. I mean, that's a really hard thing for people to take responsibility for, right? Because everybody wants to blame somebody. But it's the most empowering and liberating thing you could possibly give yourself, right? Because now all of a sudden it is, you know what? I can change my life.
You have that power. Absolutely.
Yeah. If I take responsibility for my decisions, and if I take responsibility for how I'm going to respond to certain situations, and give myself the responsibility on responding appropriately and in a way that's going to help me and not hurt me, right? I mean, when you get into the blame game, you're hurting yourself. And so,
absolutely.
Yeah, this is kind of a story of, you know, these folks took responsibility and they continued fighting well after World War II. But you know what? They won. They won. They did. And they won.
And it's funny because so the way you just phrased it is, you know, they took responsibility, right? And it's like, well, they didn't put themselves there. And I could see some of the audience might be thinking to themselves, they didn't put themselves in there. So what are they responsible for, right? They're responsible for, like what we were just talking about, they're responsible for that outcome, that
exactly.
End result.
Exactly.
And that's where the responsibility lies. You can sit there and you can point your finger and blame, you know, this person did this, this person did that, this group, the government, whoever the boogeyman is in the story, you could point at them and say, hey, these people did me wrong. Okay, so what? What's next? How are you gonna get you better? Because clearly they're not the ones who are looking out for your best interest. You are.
Right.
How do you get you better? And I think that's the importance there.
And I'll just say this, just one last thing. You know, I tell people that fear is born of weakness.
Yeah.
Fear is born of weakness, right? Love is born of strength. And I've heard one of your podcasts about self-defense, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the stronger you are, the less fearful you become.
Sure.
So take responsibility, figure out how to build that mental and physical strength. And, you know, and you'll become part of our own army that keeps bad stuff like this from happening again.
Absolutely. We'll be right back after this short break.
This message is from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Did you serve in the military? If so, you can obtain a free lifetime pass to more than 2,000 federal recreation sites, including national parks, wildlife refuges, and forests. Getting a pass is easy. Just go to the National Park Service website, nps.gov, or the National Park Service app.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Drive On. If you've missed the last couple episodes of Drive On, you might have missed that we're trying to close out each episode with a joke. Try to keep things light, a little bit humorous here. laughter can be the best medicine, and I want to be able to share some of that humor and laughter with the audience. But before we get to that and the joke, John, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you today. Where can people go to get a copy of your book and find out a little bit more information about these Japanese Americans who were so brave and so heroic during World War II?
Yeah, thank you, Scott. I have to say I am so honored to be here, and that you've given me an opportunity to speak, especially to this audience. All my love, all my respect, and thank you, and my gratitude. So the book is called American Grit: From a Japanese American Concentration Camp Rises an American War Hero. But you just have to remember American Grit. You can go to Amazon. Amazon's the easiest place, or a lot of bookstores actually are carrying it now. And go to Amazon and just search on American Grit, and you'll see John Suzuki. And I've got the hard copy. I've narrated my book, so it's on audio and also on Kindle, obviously. And for more information about me and about the book, you can go to johnsuzuki.com. And there you have my website, and there's all kinds of stuff there. But yeah, it's been wonderful being here, Scott. And thank you again for having me. It's
wonderful. You bet. I like this story that you shared. I don't like the situation, but I like the fact that we are able to look back into our history, see this dark time in our history and learn something from it and potentially grow from it and come out better from this situation. And I think that's what we all are aspiring to do, is we want better for our kids, for our grandkids and future generations. We always want to improve and get better. And so this was, I think, an important story. Definitely, I think will resonate with some of the audience here that we have, you know, given the military history and the context there, but just an important story overall.
Yeah. One thing real quick is that if you do pick up the book, when you finish it, don't put it in your bookshelf. I ask that you give it to somebody. Give it to somebody and share it with them so that they can learn about this as well. Absolutely. And, you know, it's about, you know, so I don't want you to tell them to go buy it. I'd prefer that you just give it to them.
Sure.
Make it easy and share the story.
Absolutely. All right. So time for the humor section of this show. So I don't know if you have a joke or not that you'd like to share, but if you do, by all means,
yeah.
You can go first.
I got a dad joke, which is probably so bad it's probably going to be called a grandpa joke. But what do you call a fish? What do you call a fish with no eyes?
Oh, I don't know.
A fish.
No eye.
And what did the sushi say to the bee?
I don't know.
Wasabi. I'm laughing at my own joke. It's so stupid. Anyway, I'm sorry.
That's okay. That's okay. My joke's probably not much better. So my joke, when a soldier loses their rifle in the army, the army is going to charge them like $1,000 or whatever the cost is to replace the rifle. And that's why in the Navy, the captain always goes down with the ship. They don't want to have to pay.
That's a big bill.
That's a big bill. Yeah, you don't want to be footing that bill. So, John, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I really do appreciate it.
My honor. Thank you, Scott.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to support the show, please check out Scott's book, Surviving Son, on Amazon. All of the sales from that book go directly back into this podcast and work to help veterans in need. You can also follow the Drive On Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, and wherever you listen to podcasts.